the divine souls. Yesterday I explained the 7th chapter of the Gita to you, and at the very end of the 7th chapter, Sri Krishna ji says, Vedaham samatitani vartamanani charjuna bhavishyani cha bhutani mam tu vedana kashchana. He says, O Arjun, I know everything. I know everything that has passed, everything that currently is, and everything which is destined to happen in the future. But nobody knows me. He says, he knows everything, but nobody can know him. We'll see in the 8th chapter how it is possible for someone to know him, but not through their own effort. At the beginning of the 8th chapter, and there's a mix of topics in the 8th chapter, just as there are in every chapter of the Gita. So, at the beginning of the 8th chapter, Arjuna asks Sri Krishna, after death, or when someone dies, in what situation will they get to go to you? Tell me, at that moment, when someone's dying, what determines whether they're going to go to you or not? They could go to you, they could be reborn in this world. What determines that? So Sri Krishna answered in 2 verses. Antakale cha mameva smaran mukva kalevaram yah prayati samadbhavam yati nastyatra sanshaya yam yam vapi smaran bhavam tyajatyante kalevaram tam tamevaiti kaunteya sada tadbhava bhavita. He says, antakale, at the end, a soul comes to me if he remembers me at the time that he's leaving his body. He actually says, tyaktva kalevaram. Kalevaram is your body, and tyaktva means to leave it. In fact, it means to leave it willingly. Tyaktva means tyag karna. We've never died in such a way that we've just said, I'm leaving my body. I'm out of here. We've never done that. We go forcefully. We're taken forcefully. The way an ordinary soul leaves their body is that they're actually attached to their body. They're attached to this life and everything in it. And they don't want to let go of that. They don't want to let go of their family, their possessions, their body. We all fear death for this reason. So, at the time of death, when it's time for our soul to leave our body, Yamraj sends his servants. He doesn't come personally. Yamraj is the god of death. Although the god of death sounds like a horrible, terrible thing, he's actually an employee of God. Yamraj is a member of the celestial government, the spiritual government. And he works on behalf of God. He takes care of, okay, this soul has to go here according to his karma, this soul has to go here. But he doesn't make a personal appearance for anybody, no ordinary soul. He sends his servants. They're called Yama Dut. Dut means an envoy. So they come and they actually have to forcefully remove us. You can say like kicking and screaming. We don't want to go. I remember when I was a child, I was 8 years old, and we had grown up in one house from the time I was 8 years old, and my parents sold the house and they wanted to move just 4 houses farther. We lived on a river. They were moving 4 houses upstream, up the river. And they had to drag me kicking and screaming because I was so attached to that house that I'd grown up in until I was 8 years old. So that's how we leave this body. They have to pull us forcefully and bring us to where we're going next. So we have never done tyaktva kalevaram. Tyaktva means like you're holding the paper and you willingly put it down. We've never done that. He says if someone willingly leaves their body and at that time is remembering me, then they will come to me. In this there is no doubt. He says, there is no doubt in this. If they remember me at the time they leave their body, they will come to me. This one shlok of the Gita has given rise to a lot of confusion because people translate this antakale. They don't look at the details of the whole verse, that first of all, tyaktva kalevaram, at least even if they think of when my soul is leaving my body, never mind that I'm leaving it willingly or unwillingly, they don't even think of that much that Krishna is referring to when my soul is leaving the body. They just think, oh, antakale, it must mean when I lose consciousness. And people, some people, when they're expecting death, they may start repeating a name of God, because Krishna says, you remember me. So taking his name is a way of remembering him. So when they're on their deathbed, they keep saying Ram Ram, Sham Sham, something like that. But then what happens is, at that time, if death comes at that time, let's say that person's last word was Ram or Sham. But that's not the moment they're leaving their body. That's just the moment their brain stopped working. Their senses shut down. Their brain shut down. Then what happens? Their breathing stops. Then their heart stops. But still their soul hasn't left their body. Otherwise, how could someone be resuscitated after their heart has stopped? So it's quite a bit later, quite some time after, that the soul actually leaves the body, and that's the moment of spiritual death. Meaning, that's the actual, the doctor may have pronounced you dead hours ago, but when your soul leaves your body, that's when you're really not coming back. So at that moment, we have to remember God. And at that moment, an ordinary soul is not conscious. We're unconscious. So at that time, Shri Krishna says, what will you be remembering? Because your subconscious mind will be active. He says, you'll be thinking of whatever you're attached to. Whatever you're attached to in life, whatever you spend your whole life doing chintan of, thinking of a lot, that is what you'll remember at that time, and as your soul's leaving your body, accordingly you'll be reborn. So that's why it's said that we're reborn in the field of our attachments. If we did a lot of bad actions, we might not be born as a human being again, but we'll still be reborn in the field of our attachments. Meaning we could be born as a dog or a fly or something, but if we were attached to our house, say, and we didn't want to leave it, so you could be born as a fly on the wall in your house, and someone could be chasing you around with a fly swatter. It means that we're reborn according to whatever we're attached to. It makes no difference what our last word was. In this regard, there's an example, an actual historical example from the Bhagavatam, which is described in the Bhagavatam, of Ajamin. A lot of people are familiar with the first half of the story of Ajamin. Not many people know about the second half of the story. In the first half of the story, Ajamil is described as being a very pious man. He's married, he has children, he follows all the regulations of the Vedas. He lives, he's a dharmatma. He follows dharma. And then through this one experience he has, he becomes a very fallen soul because of this one desire that's born in his mind. He becomes so infatuated with that one desire that he's willing to do anything, right or wrong, to get it. And in the process, he ends up basically, destroying his family, destroying his good name. And instead of being known as a very pious person, he's an example of a fallen soul. Someone who was so good, who became so bad. So then Bhagavatam tells that Ajamil was feeling like death was coming. Like he felt maybe he was having some kind of pain in his chest or something. He felt like, oh, I'm going to die. But at that time, what he did, he called for his son, who was in the next room. His son's name is Narayan, which is a name of God Vishnu. So when he called, oh, Narayan, Narayan, and he fell unconscious on the floor. While he was unconscious, he had a vision that Yamdut have come to take his soul, and they've come to take him to Narak, to hell because of all of his bad actions. And then as they were going to take him, Vishnudut came. The representatives of God Vishnu came and said, no, 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 you can't have him. His last word was Vishnu, not I, and so he's coming with us to the divine abode. And there was some discussion, and eventually Yamdut had to leave. And then he awoke. People don't know this part. Normally when people tell the story, they just say Yamdut had to leave, and then they finish the story by saying, and then he went to the divine abode. So they say, you see the power of the divine name? He wasn't even calling God. It just so happened that his son was named after God, but in his mind he was calling his son. So his mind was in his son, not in God, yet his son's name happened to be Narayan. So he was given entrance to the divine abode. This is how mostly the story gets told. But if you read it actually in the Bhagavatam, he did get to go to the divine abode, but there was a 1 year interval. See, what happens was he didn't die at that time. He reawoke, and that vision that he had had changed him. And he thought, no, I have to reform myself. So he left doing all the wrong things, and he went to Haridwar on the bank of Gangaji, and he did devotion to Sri Krishna for 1 whole year, and at the end of that year, his heart was fully purified, and he was surrendered to Sri Krishna. So then, he left his body and went to the divine abode. In other words, there was no loophole. People look for a loophole that, you know, it doesn't matter what I do my whole life, I'll just say God's name at the end, and then I'll go to the divine abode. And they give the example of Ajamil, and they have hope that, you know, that I'll be able to fit through that loophole as well. In fact, Ajamil didn't fit through any loophole. He had to do devotion, and he purified his heart and became surrendered to Krishna. Only then he went to the divine abode. So that's the first important lesson of the 8th chapter, that the time of death, at that time, if you haven't attached your mind to God in your life, then you're not going to remember God at the time of death. And attachment in this case means full attachment. 100% attachment, 100% surrender. In fact, you have to have become God realized in your life. Then when you die, you go automatically to the divine abode. That type of saint, a God realized saint, willingly leaves his body when the time comes. It means you don't get anything after death that you didn't have before death. Sometimes people think, oh, my Guruji gave me a mantra, and I've repeated that mantra this many times every day for the last 40, 50 years of my life. So Guruji told me that if I do that, then I'm guaranteed entrance to the divine abode. That's not the case. Unless by doing remembrance of God, maybe the mantra helps you remember God, so you keep remembering him, your heart gets 100% purified and you surrender to him, and like I described yesterday, he appears before you. Now you're God realized, and when the end comes for your physical body, you'll willingly leave it and you'll go to his divine abode, because your mind will always be in God at that point. And those of us who have done some devotion, but our heart is not fully purified, we've not attained God, we've not seen God. So if I were to die this instant, I would not go to the divine abode. Perhaps based on the devotion, some devotion that I've done, maybe I could get a human birth in my next life. Maybe not. Maybe based on the bad actions I've done, I would have to have some births or many births in lower species before I get another chance to be born as a human being. Unless I attain God before I die, I won't be going to the divine abode after I die. There's more on this at the very end of the 8th chapter, which we'll get to. In the next verse, Sri Krishna says, therefore, Arjuna, tasmat sarveshu kaleshu mamanusmara yudhyacha mayyarpitamanobuddhirmayyaveshitachetasam. He says, O Arjuna, remember me every moment. Because your mind is active every moment, it's thinking of something, so direct your mind towards me, direct your thoughts towards me, and even while you're working in the world, you should keep thinking of me. He says, Yudhyacha, Arjuna, fight the war, but while you're fighting the war, keep your mind in me. Mayi arpita mano buddhi. Mayi arpit. Arpit means to surrender. Mayi, to me, Sri Krishna says, your man and buddhi. Your emotional mind and your intellectual mind. Your heart and your intellect, you can say. Surrender both of those to Sri Krishna, then he says, then you will come to me. There is no doubt. You will attain me. These are ultimate states that he's talking about. Remembering him every second, even while we work in the world. Giving our heart and intellect to him fully. That's the goal. We have to reach that point. How to reach that point, he tells. He says there are two main ways that people do this. How they condition their mind to think about me more and more. And in that way they become surrendered to me. First he tells the difficult way, then he tells the easy way. Sarvadvarani samyamya mano hridi niruddhyacha murdhnyadhayatmana prana masthito yoga dharanam om ityekaksharam brahma Vyaharan mamanusmaran yah prayati tyajam deham. He says, this person who follows yoga and the path of jnana are very similar, like parallel paths, you can say, or they're complementary paths. A jnani does yoga and the yogi does jnana. So here Sri Krishna summarizes the entire eightfold path of yoga. Ashtanga yoga, as described by sage Patanjali in the Patanjali Yoga Darshan, is summarized in these two shlokas by Sri Krishna. He says that by practicing yoga, as described by sage Patanjali, you will be able to control your breathing, your prana, control your senses, which means to kind of close them off and not allow them to always be going out and looking to enjoy the world. Control your prana and bring it here to the top of your head. Control your man here in your heart. And having done that, he says, ma manusmaran. Ma means me, anusmaran means remember. And om ityekaksharam brahma vyaharan. Say om and remember me. This is the whole path of yoga in gist. There are steps before that where you have to discipline your behavior and practice asanas. He's not mentioning that. It's a very long, arduous path. Eventually someone may succeed in getting all of that under control. Their breath, their prana, their mind, their senses, everything. So he says at that point, which could actually take you many lifetimes of practice of yoga to get to such a high level, he says at this point, now you're ready to do this meditation, which he calls yoga dharana. Once you've reached this level, you're at yoga dharana. After that comes dhyana, and after that comes samadhi. Dhyana means meditation. So what meditation do you do? He says, repeat om and think of me. But you're thinking of Krishna's formless aspect. It's not someone different. Brahma om pratishtaham. In Gita, Sri Krishna says, Brahma, formless God, is established in me like rays of the sun are established in the sun. They come from the sun. So think of me in my formless aspect. So that's called abheda bhakti. It's worshipping God in His formless form. You think of my soul is divine, and God is the soul of my soul, and He's inside of me, I'm His ansh. But you're not thinking of Krishna necessarily in the yogi's not meditating on Krishna with a flute and peacock feather. He's just thinking, okay, it's you, Krishna, but I'm thinking of your formless aspect. This is the meditation that the yogis and jnanis do. In this way, they enter into samadhi, and for lifetimes, they have to practice this samadhi, and that purifies their heart. Then, when they've fully purified their heart and they've surrendered to Sri Krishna, with His grace, they can realize that formless aspect of Him. Then when they leave their body, they go to Him. They merge in His formless aspect. That's the hard way. That requires total renunciation from the world, long, long hours of yoga and meditation, really no involvement in worldly activities, just 100% dedication all the time to the path of yoga. The next way he describes is the easy way. Ananya cheta satatam yomam smarati nityashah tasyaham sulabha partha nitya yuktasya yogina. He says, I am sulabh. Sulabh means easily attainable by the one who exclusively, lovingly devotes himself to me. He uses a few words in this shloka. Ananya. Ananya means exclusive. Ananya cheta, your chet, your heart, should be exclusively attached to Sri Krishna. Satatam means all the time, unbroken remembrance. Yo mam smarati, the one who does smaran of me. Smaran means remembrance, thinking of Krishna. Nityasha, all the time. See, he says satatam, he says nityasha, they both mean the same thing. And the next line, he says tasyaham, for that person, I am sulabh. And nitya yuktasya yogina. He calls this person a yogi also, because he's joining his mind with Sri Krishna, and yog means to join. So the devotee is also called a yogi. Anyone surrendering his mind to Krishna is called a yogi. But this yogi is following an easier path of yoga. This is called bhakti yoga. He joins his mind with Sri Krishna through bhakti. But he still, the condition is still, he should exclusively try to attach his mind to Krishna, and he should try to remember him all the time. But he does it by thinking of Krishna's personal form, and he can start doing it no matter where he is in his spiritual progress. The other yogi, the Gyan yogi, who is trying to meditate on Krishna's formless aspect, he can't qualify for that meditation to really do it properly until he's developed total renunciation from the world and control over his body, senses, mind, breathing, everything. Then he can do that meditation, because thinking of formless God is extremely difficult. He talks more about this in the 12th chapter. But the one who worships him in his personal form, it's very easy, because to think of God in his personal form is very natural for us. We can, just like we can imagine a person in our mind, we can think of Sri Krishna. It's very simple. And we can imagine him in any form we want, with any decorations. There's no rule of how Sri Krishna has to look if you're meditating on his personal form. Because truly we can't imagine his actual divine form until we get God realized. So he says, whatever appeals to you, you think of that, and I'll accept that as if you're actually meditating on me. Because your intention is to meditate on me, that's good enough. I give you the result of your intention. That makes it very easy. We can think of Krishna as young, grown up, old, tall, short, fat, skinny, dark complexion, fair complexion, dressed in any way we want. And as long as we have the intention that this is Sri Krishna, He accepts our meditation. If we're not good at meditating, maybe you see things fuzzy or in black and white, you don't have a very artistic imagination, He doesn't penalize you for that. That, oh, your imagination of me is so ugly. I'm much more beautiful than that. He knows that whatever our imagination is going to be, we're doing it with our material mind. So Krishna's unlimited divine beauty would be impossible for us to imagine with a material mind. So He doesn't care. He's looking for our effort. That's why finding Him in this way through the path of bhakti is very easy. It doesn't matter how attached you are in the world. You don't have to leave your worldly activities or responsibilities in order to follow this path of devotion. So He says, I'm much more easily attainable through this method. Now He changes the topic a little bit. I told you there are normally several topics in each chapter, and sometimes they're repeated throughout the chapters. He talks about the extent of mayic existence. Ah, Brahma Bhuvana Loka Punaravartino Arjuna Mam Upetya Tu Kaunteya Punarjanmana Vidyate. He tells Arjuna that there are celestial abodes. In fact, he's described this in the previous chapters, the Swarg. Swarg is a part of Maya, so it's also produced by the same material energy that this world, this physical world, is produced by. But the celestial abodes are not reachable in this physical body. When you die, if you've done a lot of good actions, you can gain entrance to Swarg and you get a celestial body, and over there you can enjoy the pleasures of Swarg, but for a limited time, because you did a limited number of good actions to gain access, so eventually that access is used up and you enjoy away the effect of your good actions and you have to come back here. And there are many different abodes. In fact, there are 10 main celestial abodes. Each one has higher and higher material pleasures. Not divine pleasures, material pleasures. The highest one is Brahma's abode. So here, Sri Krishna says, even if someone goes to Brahma's abode, they would still end up having to come back into this physical world. But if someone comes to me, then they would never have to be reborn. So that's the limit. Brahma's abode is the extent of Maya. Someone who goes beyond that, goes beyond Maya, attains Sri Krishna, and is never born in this world again. Excuse me, I need a little water. Then he tells more about Brahma and the duration of Brahma's abode. Sahasra yuga paryanta maharyat brahmano vidhu ratrim yuga sahasrantam. He tells the duration of one of Brahma's days and one of Brahma's nights. So here there's some math involved. He says 1,000 mahayuga equals one day of Brahma, and the same duration is Brahma's night. A Mahayug is one time around the four yugas. There are four yugas. The current one we're in is Kaliyug. That's actually considered the fourth yug. The first yug is Satyug. Then it's Tretayug. Then Dwaparayug. Then Kaliyug. Those four yugas together, to go around all four of those, takes 4,320,000 years. I'll give you the breakdown. Kali Yuga is 432,000 years long. 432,000 years for Kali Yuga. That's the shortest yuga. The one before that, Dwapar Yuga, is twice as long as Kali Yuga. It's 864,000 years long. The one before that, Treta Yuga, is three times as long as Kali Yuga. So it's 1,296,000 years long. And the first Yuga, Sat Yuga, is four times as long as Kali Yuga. So that's 1,728,000 years long. You add them all up, it comes to 4,320,000 years. That's one day of Brahma, one Mahayuga. His night is the same duration. And what happens during his day and night, Sri Krishna tells. Avyakta Vyaktaya Sarva Prabhavantyaharagame Ratriagame Pradiyante Tatraiva Vyakta Samyake. He says, during Brahma's night, everything comes back into Brahma. Let me tell you who Brahma is. Brahma is the creator of our Brahmand. Brahmand is Brahma plus And. And means egg-shaped, elliptical. That's the shape of our planetary system. So it's called a Brahmand. Because it's made by Brahma and it's egg-shaped. But in our universe, of which there's only one, there's one single universe, but the universe goes on forever in every direction. Devi Bhagavat Purana says, Sankhya Chet Rajasamasti Navishvanam Kadachana Brahma Vishnu Shivadinam Sankhya Chet Na Chidatmani. You can't count the number of planetary systems, Brahmand, that there are in this unlimited universe. There's no limit to it. It's unlimited. The universe is unlimited and the number of Brahmand is also unlimited. And in every Brahmand, there's a Brahma who creates that Brahmand. Not the whole, he doesn't create the whole universe, he creates that Brahmand. And there's one Vishnu who protects that Brahmand, and there's one Shiva who destroys that Brahmand. This similar setup is in every Brahmand. And all of these Vishnus, Shivas, and Brahmas, they are all a form of Mahavishnu. Or you can say they all report back to Mahavishnu, who is the creator of the whole universe. And he is one ansh of Sri Krishna's personality. He is Sri Krishna's almighty self, you can say. Sri Krishna, when he wants to create the entire universe, he takes his form as Mahavishnu. He manifests the whole universe by activating Maya. And then there's a long description in the Bhagavatam of how it happens. I'm giving you the gist. He creates unlimited number of pockets where there will be a Brahman in each one. And he descends, or Mahavishnu, in the form of Mahavishnu, he descends as Vishnu of that Brahman in each and every Brahman. And then Vishnu of that Brahman produces Brahma. And Shivji also comes from the divine abode and takes up residence in each and every Brahman. So our Brahma is responsible for our little Brahman. And there are other Brahmas responsible for other Brahmandas. Now, Brahma's day is very long, as I told you. For him, it feels like 12 hours. For us, it's 4,320,000,000 years. Because one Mahayuga is 4,320,000 years, and Sri Krishna says 1,000 times around. The four yugas is equal to a day of Brahma. So 1,000 times 4.32 million is 4.32 billion. So in fact, that is the duration of Brahma's day, is 4,320,000,000 years of our years. For him, it's 12 hours. His time, the dimension that he lives in has a different time factor than ours. In Maya, there's different types of matter and there's different time factors depending what Mayic dimension you're in. So we're in this physical dimension. Brahma is in the topmost dimension of Swarga, so his time factor is a little different than ours. During his night, Brahma dissolves all of this. So all the souls during Brahma's night, whatever souls are living on that earth planet, they go into Brahma and they stay there like in a dormant state. And also there's no life left on earth. The whole thing is dissolved. Then, during the beginning of Brahma's next day, he again sends everything forth. And every life is reestablished on earth, on the same earth, and we start again. This happens 36,000 times in Brahma's life. Because Brahma lives for 100 years. He has a day and a night, and he has 360 days in his year, and he lives for 100 years. So 360 days times 100 is 36,000. He lives for 36,000 days. Our Earth planet is halfway through Brahma's life, which if you add it up in our years, it's 155,520,000,000,000 years that we've been here. And Brahma, the total life of this Earth planet would be 311,040,000,000,000 years. According to these calculations that I've given you, if you keep adding it up, that's what you'll come to. Then Sri Krishna says, parastasmātu bhāvonyo vyakto vyaktāt sanātana yah sarveshu bhūteshu nashyatsu navinashyati. He says there's something else beyond this. You see, this whole thing that's going on where Brahma is dissolving and then manifesting our Brahmand, and the souls go into him and come back out of him. This keeps happening for the life of our Earth planet. And even if you go beyond this, the entire universe goes through a similar cycle, but the period of time is much, much longer. It's uncountable. The universe, the whole universe, uncountable Brahmandas, they merge into God during Mahapralaya, and then he again sends everything forth when he re-manifests the universe. So the entire universe is dissolved and manifested in a cyclic way as well. He says, when it's dissolved, it dissolves into avyakt. Avyakt means unmanifest. And then when it's manifest, well, it's vyakt. He says there's something beyond that avyakt. You see, when the whole universe is dissolved, it's avyakt. So you can say, nothing remains. Sri Krishna says, no, something remains. There's something divine beyond all this material existence. He says, that's me. So I'm beyond all of this. I'm here, I was here before, I'm here now, and I'll be here after. So even when the universe is destroyed, Sri Krishna is still there, and his divine abode is still there. It means that his divine abode, his existence and the existence of his divine abode is stable and permanent. It's unaffected by the creation or dissolution of the physical universe. It's a stable divine existence. There's never a creation or dissolution over there in the divine world. It's just always there. And God is always there, and the souls who attain God, they're also always there. The divine world doesn't get dissolved and then the souls become inactive. Over there, they just keep enjoying the divine bliss all the time. So how to get there? He says, bhaktya labhyasmananyaya. You attain that param purush. The param purush means the supreme divine personality of God in his personal form as Sri Krishna. who is beyond all this mayic energy, you attain him through bhakti, through ananya bhakti, single-minded devotion. Ananya is a word that comes up at many, many places in the Gita. And it's a very important concept. It means loving Shri Krishna only. That's true devotion. He alone is ours. He alone was ours before this life, will remain ours after this life. Everybody else comes and goes. That's one constant relationship. So he is our only true relation. So we should give our mind to him exclusively. This is ananyata, means exclusiveness. Ananya bhakti, exclusive devotion to Shri Krishna. That results in God realization. To become ananya, we have to practice bhakti. That's the goal. If we were to become ananya, we'd get God realized that instant. To get to that point, we have to do devotion, which means remembering him as much as possible throughout the day, whether we're working or whether we're sitting and doing devotion without being involved in any other worldly activity. We have to think of him as much as possible in a loving, faithful way. Do what we call Rup Dhyan. Think of his form. Feel that he's here with you. Now we'll go to the end of the 8th chapter. The last series of verses at the end of the 8th chapter uses a term, Kaal. Kaal, people generally translate as time. So Shri Krishna says, O Arjuna, I'm going to tell you now about the time during which, if a person leaves their body, they come to me. And I'll also tell you about the time during which, if a person leaves their body, they don't come to me. One is called the path of light and one is called the path of darkness. The path of darkness keeps you under Maya and the path of light takes you beyond Maya and we go to Shri Krishna. He's speaking metaphorically here. You see, there's a Uttarayan, means from early in the year, from Makar Sankranti for the next 6 months. That's called Uttarayan, the light 6 months. And after that, it's called Dakshinayan. It means the dark 6 months for the second half of the year. He's speaking metaphorically, but people take that to mean, because he's using these astrological terms, light half of the year, dark half of the year. So in astrological terms, that means, you know, from June to December is the dark half, and from January to June, that's the light half. So people take these verses to mean, if you die during Uttarayan, you'll go to Shri Krishna, and they give the example of Bhishma, that he, because he could decide when he wanted to leave his body, he waited for months to die until January 14th came. And he left his body on that day, on Makar Sankranti day. So people think he was waiting to do that so that he would be guaranteed to go to the divine world. But this is another way of looking for a loophole. Just like we're looking for the loophole of the example of Ajamil, people look for a loophole like, oh, it's that easy? I just die in the first half of the year and I'll go to the divine abode? No, that's not what he means. He's speaking metaphorically, and what he means is the path of light is the path of surrender to him. And the path of darkness is everything else. He says in the last verse, Vedeshu yagyeshu tapah suchayiva daneshu yak punya phalam pradishtam it. Yeti tat sarvamidam viditva yogi param sthanam upaiti chadyam. He says, you know what he calls the dark path? He names all the good actions that are told in the Vedas. He says, Vedeshu, studying the Vedas. Yagyeshu, doing Vedic rituals. Tap, doing austerities, pious austerities. Daneshu, giving charity. Can you imagine? He says that's the path of darkness. But he's trying to make a very specific point. Those are not bad things to do. But he's saying, if you do all of those things without surrendering your mind to me, you stay under Maya. So that's the path of darkness, because you're reborn in the darkness of Maya. And whether you do those things or you don't do those things, if you surrender your mind to me, you come to me. That's the path of light. So you can do those things if you want, but you better have your mind attached to me. Only then you're following the path of light, and only then you'll go beyond to Maya, you'll go beyond Maya and attain Sri Krishna. So this is the gist of the 8th chapter. In the 9th chapter, which we'll take up tomorrow, there's a beautiful description of the general grace of Sri Krishna and the special grace of Sri Krishna. General grace, which is on all the souls, and special grace, which is received by a few souls who fulfill a certain condition. So what is that? We'll see tomorrow.